In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing in your
time. Al Kent on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine, shiny shoes and
Tony Home Permanent presents...
This is Nora Drake.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, New Britain, Connecticut. Safety, service, and growth have been the hallmarks of Burritt's progress, all built on the premise of good customer service.
This is Dick Bertel, and with me is the man with 2,000 hours of old-time radio memories on tape, Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, our guest tonight has appeared in just about every entertainment medium there is. He was a star in radio, in television, on the stage, and in motion pictures.
Yes, Dick, and some of the roles this gentleman played was Ethelbert in the Casey Crime Photographer. He was Connie in Terry and the Pirates. Red Pennington in the very famous kids show, Don Winslow of the Navy. I might add that this gentleman, probably the most well-liked man in all radio.
And, I think perhaps one of the most familiar voices in all of radio. And, of course, if our radio audience had the opportunity to see our guest, they'd recognize him immediately, having seen him on such shows as Sergeant Bilko and The Defenders and Edge of Night and many, many commercials. Without further ado, let's introduce our guest tonight, John Gibson. John, it's a pleasure to have you with us on The Golden Age.
Well, thank you. I think I'm happy to be here, but I'm a little nervous.
You know, this is something that really amazes me. When we have the opportunity to interview people with experience such as yours, and we found this in one of our recent shows with Peg Lynch, she is frightened of a microphone. And you feel the same way.
Absolutely. I don't think I'm second to anybody in volume of shows as an actor, as a freelance actor. I do believe that I have done somewhere over 10,000 radio shows, or appearances, if you want to call them, or whatever. And I am still very nervous, because usually people assume that radio was comparatively easy, as I do, standing in a well-lighted studio with a nice script in front of you, and all you have to do is read the lines.
Right.
But you can say some awfully strange things by mistake, and your tongue can get twisted. As you know, there have been some classics.
I begin to get the picture. John, you really began with motion pictures, the silent days of motion pictures, back on the coast in 1925, if I might throw in that date.
That's right, 1925 in the silence, and they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. That was a wonderful, wonderful era. I'm afraid the whole thing is gone now, even the talkies and all, as far as Hollywood goes. It isn't what it was then.
Mm-hmm.
It was so wonderful because you could do things wrong and they could edit it out and no sound, you know. And it was sort of a human kind of a thing. You could eat afterward, you know.
That's right. You know, you played perhaps one of the most familiar characters to children of all ages that has ever appeared on the motion picture screen, and people don't realize this. And to really tell the story and put it into perspective, we have to go back to 1932. What was the name of that program and the character you created on radio?
That was Globe Headlines, and the character was Sleepy Dolan.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly anyone now living will ever remember that. But Sleepy was a newspaper photographer, and he was a funny character, and it started me in radio. As a result, for example, Disney used me in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
You were Sleepy.
That's right.
Not only were you the voice of Sleepy, most people don't realize this. Until a few minutes ago, I didn't realize this. You were the actor.
Well, in my credits, I always say created the role of Sleepy, because people always think of the voice only in an animated cartoon. But I believe Snow White was the first, and as far as I know, the only ambitious effort where they photographed the actors with a movie camera. We worked in our street clothes with props. And then they drew the cartoon frame by frame from the film we had made.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they duplicated such tiny things as a bat of an eye, so that everything that showed in the cartoon had actually been performed.
No wonder it's so masterful even today, some, 33 years later.
That's right.
Well, John, we'll get back to your career, and we'll hear an excerpt from one of the many shows in which you appeared right after this.
Choosing where you will bank is for some people a matter of taste or convenience. For others, a matter of economics. Banking at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank might satisfy all of these preferences for you. Over the years, since 1889 to be exact, Burritt has always tried to be friendly and cooperative in its relationship with people. Our officers and tellers are particularly selected for these qualities. From a business standpoint, Burritt is large, strong, and successful. It is a mutual type of institution organized and operated for you, the customer. Offices are maintained at two locations in New Britain, at Corbin's Corner in West Hartford, and another will be open this fall on Town Line Road, Rocky Hill, to serve Wethersfield and Rocky Hill people. You are always welcome at Burritt, either as a depositor or a borrower. As the only bank in New England with Mutual in its name, we have to live up to the reputation of being the People's Bank. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, member FDIC.
Well, Ed, before we talk more to John Gibson about his career, let's hear John Gibson, the actor.
Yes, Dick, I selected a wide variety of roles that John played in because he's a man of many voices and many characterizations. And the first one, he plays a Brooklyn cab driver in a very familiar show, Nick Carter, the Master Detective.
What's the matter? What is it?
Another case for Nick Carter, Master Detective.
Yes, it's another case for that most famous of all manhunters, the detective whose ability at solving crime is unequaled in the case of detective fiction, Nick Carter, Master Detective. Tonight's curious adventure,
The Corpse in the Cab, or Nick Carter and the Mystery of the Murder in the Park.
Taxi!
Mr. Ramsey, you are very kind indeed to take such an interest in this problem.
Well, dear fellow, I consider it my civic duty. Taxi!
Ah, here's a cab now.
Yes.
Okay, gents, make it snappy. We're blocking traffic.
All right. You get in first. My party, you know, my party.
Thank you. Where to, gents?
I guess the quickest way to get there is through the park. Yes, drive through the park. I'll tell you where to turn.
Okay. I believe it is on West 54th Street. And there's a flag out there.
Excuse me, driver.
Yeah?
Do you mind if I shut this glass partition between us?
Go right ahead, boss. You're paying the fare.
Here, let me do it for you.
Well, that's better. Nice winter evening. Stars twinkling. Ought to pick us up for the grim business ahead. Lucky thing I ran into you. Yes, lucky thing. Just my little way of keeping air out of the windpipe. There you are, my dear fellow. Mighty lucky thing I ran into you tonight.
You gotta help me, Nick. You gotta. They'll slap me and stir.
Now, take it easy, Shorty. Take it easy. And tell me again exactly what happened.
Like I said, two guys hail my cab. One of them says to drive through the park. He'll tell me where to turn up.
And when you get out of the park?
The one guy opens the partition again and says to pull up. He's getting out. He tells me to drive the other guy to the precinct police station. And, Nick, if I hadn't looked around when I came to the intersection and seen what I seen, I'd have driven right up to the bull house with a dead body in my cab. Me, Shorty Bentano.
You don't remember what the man looked like, Shorty.
In the dark? I ain't got cat's eyes, Nick. Gee, what's that?
You are jumpy. And just Patsy buzzing me in the talkback.
Oh.
Nick, in the inimitable words of Mr. Winchell, my stomach and my backbone are now a twosome. When do we eat?
You'll have to order yourself a sandwich, Patsy. We've got work to do.
Work? Tonight?
Mm-hmm. And, Patsy, get me to police headquarters. Lieutenant Riley.
Okay, Nick.
You're going to turn me in, Nick? I thought you'd help me.
I am going to help you, Shorty. But the sooner the police know about the murdered man outside in your cab, the better it is for you.
You're crazy, Nick. I done time. I ain't got a chance. If the cops find that stiff in my buggy, it's curtains for me. I'm getting out of here.
Shorty, sit down there.
Nick, they'll give me the hot seat for something I never done.
No, they won't, Shorty. Not while my name's Nick Carter.
Well, Shorty, you had quite a record, didn't you? John, do you remember your first network broadcast at all?
It was the first coast-to-coast broadcast I ever did, and it was with the Marx Brothers from Hollywood. The RCA studios, they broadcast from there. I think it was NBC.
Now, did you do a lot of network roles from the coast, or did you move to New York?
No, I did many network shows until 1939, and then I moved to New York, yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Why did you move to New York? It would seem to me that Hollywood would be the center for actors.
We had great respect for New York actors. The theory was that if you could make a go in New York, you could make it anywhere in the world. That this was the absolute top, and I was very impressed with the town. Unfortunately, I don't feel quite the same way today, but I was very impressed. And so it was an idea of moving to the big city. I was a bachelor then, and I was, it didn't matter much where I was. And so I decided to try New York.
Well, we're going to hear one of your best roles. As a matter of fact, Ed, you're the historian here. How long did John Gibson play Ethelbert in Casey Crime Photographer?
I would guess about 11 years. Is that right, John?
I say nine. Mm-hmm. Stotz Cotsworth, who played Casey 99% of the time, I think he said 10 or 11.
10 or 11.
Either one could be right.
Well, set the scene, will
this,
you?
This particular show is the one I think that you're most remembered for, because is that length of time. You played the role of Ethelbert, the bartender, and we'll hear a little piano music in the background.
That's right.
Herman Chittison, wasn't it, the Blue Note pianist?
Herman Chittison first, and then Teddy Wilson later.
Well, quite an improvement.
The Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation brings you Crime Photographer.
Ethelbert, what on earth's going on over there?
Oh, that's Grace. I can't get her away from that piano.
Tell her to let Herman play.
Oh, Grace, that's enough. Thanks.
Besides, this is the famous noise abatement week.
Well, it may be famous, Casey, but it's not as famous as my favorite line. Anchor Hawking is the most famous name in glass. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tony Marvin. Every week at this time, the Anchor Hawking Glass Corporation of Lancaster, Ohio, and its more than 10,000 employees bring you another adventure of Casey, Crime Photographer. ace cameraman who covers the crime news of a great city. Written by Alonzo Dean Cole, our adventure for tonight, King of the Apes. Mid-afternoon, the Blue Note Cafe. Leaning comfortably on the bar are Casey and Ann Williams. And behind the bar, it's Chief Custodian Ethelbert.
You and Miss Williams are going to the circus tonight, huh, Casey?
Yeah, we gotta go, pal. It's an assignment.
Every year, Ethelbert, he's found an excuse to go to the circus.
You think I like to go to the circus, honey?
Well, if you don't, you'd better reserve yourself a chair in the old men's home.
She's right, Casey. Any guy who can't enjoy the circus is slipping, and fast.
I love the clowns and the elephants.
I still like the brass bands and the peanuts and popcorn.
Well, I go for the lady bareback riders and the lady acrobats and the lady...
That's enough.
Well, I just wanted to establish that I'm not slipping, Annie. I'm simply matured, that's all.
What kind of assignment you two got at the big show?
Principally, we're covering the feature act, King of the Apes.
They say that's swell. According to pictures on the billboards, that fella, the king, keeps 20 or 30 giant gorillas under his complete control.
Now, circus posters sometimes exaggerate a little bit, Ethelbert. The 20 or 30 giant gorillas are really 6 orangutans.
And their trainer isn't the king. His name is King. Charles King.
Oh. But an orangutan is a pretty big monkey, eh?
Big enough. A full-grown male can break a couple of Joe Louis's in two.
Then I guess 6 orangutans are plenty for a guy to go into a cage alone with.
I'd say so. Well, we better get over to the circus, Annie. It's nearly time for our date.
Yeah.
I thought you said you were going to the circus tonight.
We're interviewing Mr. King after the matinee performance. We're seeing the show tonight.
Oh.
Well, so long, pal.
So long, Ethelbert.
Have a good time, and don't let him lock you up in the monkey cage.
Nuts to you, pal, and so long.
So long, Casey. And nuts to you.
Well, John, it's a great role, and it's great to hear Ethelbert again. We'll be back in a moment.
Susie, hand me the phone book, will you, please? What are you looking for, Kathy?
Banks. Savings banks. Let's see. Here's one in the yellow pages. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Main Street, New Britain. Slater Road, New Britain. Corbin's Corner, West Hartford. Compounds dividends monthly. Pays day of deposit to day of withdrawal interest. Certificates of deposit at 6% for 2 years and 5.75% for 1 year.
You want to start a savings bank account, Kathy?
Yes, and definitely at Burritt.
Why Burritt?
Because it's a mutual bank, Susie. It's working for us. You own part of it if you're a depositor, and its profits go to you.
Say, can I start an account there with you, Kathy? Gosh, I'd love to have a bank working for me.
John Gibson is our guest tonight, and we are reviewing that golden age of radio, and certainly a golden career during that age. John, let's talk about some of the early successes that you had when you came to New York. Were you able to move right in? You certainly had a reputation behind you.
Yes, that's true. Yes, it was wonderful in New York because I did go to work right away, and I worked very hard and very long and did, almost broke records for volume of work.
You did so many shows that at times, I guess you were really literally traveling from one studio to another.
We used to, it wasn't uncommon, let's put it this way, to do 10 shows in one day or one 24-hour period. That was because you pre-recorded 5 episodes of a series, usually 15-minute episodes. You would record like most of the day to make all of the recordings for the next week. And then in the evening you might record 5 again of another series.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 shows in a day was no great record. Many people did it. My record, I think, was 7 separate shows on 3 or 4 different networks in one day. And it included everything from crime photographer to a show with Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, to a thing about Babe Ruth, to narrating something for the community chess program. plus a couple of episodes of daytime soap opera type things.
Now, what about rehearsals? How did you get a chance to rehearse, for example, if you were traveling from one show to another?
Well, the union rules were that you had to hire a stand-in if you couldn't be there. So you hired another actor, and you paid him to be there and to play your role. And sometimes you had two or three actors stationed around town playing roles for you. And so I had to get out and run like mad. Across town and run into the studio and grab the microphone and my script and go on the air. It was frightening.
Also, John, you're somewhat of a comedian. Maybe we haven't mentioned that yet, but we have an excerpt here, Dick, the Milton Berle show, where John gets a few laughs from the audience.
And I suppose it must have been delightful to get out of some of these heavier roles, John, and just let yourself go in front of a live audience, was it?
It was, because there is nothing to me like comedy. But I was confined to heavy dramas, usually. You wouldn't think so from what you've heard tonight, but I did do a lot of heavy dramas. And I had a sort of side career that was very profitable and very successful in its way of doing comedy on radio along with the dramatic shows.
And let's listen to Milton Berle and this excerpt in just a moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, this announcement is for the special attention of the Wethersfield and Rocky Hill residents. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank will open a new branch in your area this fall. A bright new office, staffed by people from Rocky Hill and Wethersfield, will open in the Charles Schneer Shopping Center on Town Line Road in Rocky Hill. This center is just south of the Clam Box Restaurant at the border of your two towns. Caldor's has already opened there. Watch for announcements of this opening. Remember, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the bank that has mutual in its name and where you, the depositor, own the bank. It's coming to your area, and soon.
And now, for our musical guest of honor, he is none other than that great Metropolitan Opera star whose powerful, thundering bass voice has rocked opera houses all over the world. The one and only Mario Featherfield. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Featherfield.
Thank you, Mr. Berle. My heart brims over for this glorious opportunity to thank the many opera lovers who have seen me sing out front and rushed out and grabbed me backstage.
Mr. Featherfield, I understand that when you sing at the Met, you receive more flowers than any other singer.
That's true. There's only one thing wrong.
What?
All the flowers say, rest in peace.
Mr. Featherfield, how did you get your start in opera?
I was assistant to Lawrence Tibbett. He couldn't get along without me.
He couldn't?
No. Remember when Tibbett used to sing, Pretty Pagliacci?
You were with him?
Who do you think tickled him?
Mr. Featherfield, hearing you talk, isn't your voice a little weak for opera?
Oh, I was holding back.
You were, eh? You were holding back.
In Tristan and Isolde at one place, I yelled for Isolde.
Mario Featherfield, we've heard so much about your wife. Has your wife ever appeared with you?
Oh, yes. Last week, we were both in the big bullfight scene in Carmen. I was the bullfighter.
I see. And your wife?
Mm-hmm. The bull.
The bull. What a bullfight that must have been.
Ooh, huh? What a fight. The bull came charging low, and the fight was all over.
Well, what happened?
It was the first time in the history of Carmen that the bullfighter won on a foul.
Thank you very much, Mr. Featherfield. Thank you very much.
And our thanks to Milton Berle and, of course, to John Gibson for that delightful excerpt. I want to remind our listeners that they are listening to the Golden Age of Radio from WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut. I'm Dick Bertel. With me is the co-host of this program, the man with more than 2,000 hours of old-time radio memories, filed away in his attic and in his cellar
and on tape
in the garage. That's Corcoran. And our special guest tonight is John Gibson, one of the great names in radio and in television today. As a matter of fact, John, if I might pause to talk about your current career, you're very active in TV, especially commercial work.
That's right. Practically nothing but commercials right now.
And there is a word called residuals, I understand.
Yes, there's something like that. I vaguely remember getting checks.
You know, I do want to get to our next excerpt, and certainly we want to talk about this era of radio, and that, of course, is the children's serials. You appeared as Red Pennington in Don Winslow of the Navy.
Right.
I listened to you faithfully every night, never thought I'd have the opportunity to meet you. And I listened to you as Connie and Terry and the Pirates. Were those shows fun to do? Were they as much fun to do as they were to listen to?
Yes. There, if there ever was a relaxed moment, free of tensions and nerves, it was the series that you went on and on with for maybe 2, 3, 4, 5. Terry and the Pirates, I played Connie 6 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I think 2 or 3 years of Don Winslow. And you got so pretty well established and relaxed in those things, yes. And they were fun. They were wonderful fun.
Well, of course, it was great escapism for everybody in those days, as television is today.
Yes.
And we're going to hear from Terry and the Pirates and Connie.
Terry and the Pirates! The American Broadcasting Company brings you Terry and the Pirates. You know, it's a strange thing about young Terry Lee and his pals. They can get into more trouble, into more exciting spots, and battle their way out and have more fun doing it than anybody ever knew. Yes, and they use their heads, too, as well as their fists. And you'll find them laughing as they fight on this great, thrilling summertime action show. And so, across the world to ancient China. And the start of a new adventure. Escape in August. Terry Lee, together with Pat Ryan and their friends, went to the Chinese mountains to recover an amazing radio invention stolen from them by the dreaded Dragon Lady. And now, after days of difficulty, Pat and Terry have the little radio device with them. Ah, but all is not so certain, for these two daring Americans are hiding under a pile of hay in a Chinese wagon. They're trying to escape to Chongqing, to get away from the Dragon Lady. But now the wagon is halted on the road. And as Terry moves a bit of the hay that covers him, he can see back down the mountain road.
There's a car coming, Pat.
Huh?
It must be coming from Wutong.
Coming from... Hey, Terry, what do you suppose this is?
It's the car from the Dragon Lady's place.
Might have figured that much. Well, fella, they're not going to drag us back to Wutong without a fight.
You still have that gun you took from...
Yeah, I got it. And you keep that radio transmitter close to you.
Hey, what about Connie?
Well, what can he do?
Yeah, that's so. He's up front. He doesn't know we're under all this hay back here anyway.
Better let him stay up there on the driver's seat. After all, nobody's after Connie. The DL told him he could go. Uh-oh. Here comes trouble, fella. Yeah, plenty of trouble. Guess who's in that car?
I don't have to guess. It's Mr. Keith.
Yeah, and somebody else.
Hey, you there, father. Come here. We will be for making talking with you.
It's Ding Dong, the giant wrestler.
Yeah, he's driving the car for Kiel.
You heard, you boy on wagon seat. Come on.
Perhaps you are speaking to Connie?
You said it, friend. You said it.
Is something topsy-turtle I am expecting?
Yes, plenty wrong, feller.
Hey, when Connie and Ding Dong get to talking together, nobody will understand anything.
Shh. Maybe we can hear what they say.
Right.
You are lost, perhaps going north-south when road is otherwise.
What has happened to your friends, my friend?
Oh, so sorry, Honorable Dinky. By the bones of my ancestors,
I am not interested in the bones of your Aunt Esther. I am very much interested in the bones of your friends.
That sounds like fun, but this was all taken very seriously, John.
Oh, yes, very seriously.
I think that we were discussing as that was being played, children would be able to see through a character that
yes.
was trying to put it on.
Put it on
a bit,
heavy,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
Well, if you sold to children, you had to sell hard. They had to believe you, yes. And they are, I think, very clever. I think they would detect any insincerity. Of all humans, I think children would be hard to fool in anything of a dramatic nature.
Well, of course, John played opposite a number of Hollywood actors, Ed, in his radio career.
Yes, we were talking before we were on the air about Clark Gable, who, you know, you talk about Hollywood, you have to talk about Clark Gable. And you
sure.
did a lot of radio shows with him, and you did a couple of pictures with him.
That's
and,
right.
I wonder whether you could just give us a little, you know, your impression of Clark Gable as a man or as an actor, since you work with him so often.
Yes. First, let me say that I can speak of him in the highest possible terms. I think he was very much a man's man and very much a gentleman and one of nature's noblemen, as they say, but I think he was a very fine person. The thing that people seem to be shocked when I say it is that, in my opinion, he was a shy man. You don't associate that with the characters he played, but I think that he was very shy unless he knew somebody very well. He was retiring and shy. This I firmly believe. This is my slant on him. I worked with him many times in many different broadcasts. Oddly enough, people don't think of Gable in connection with radio, but he did many appearances on radio.
Yes, I've got quite a few of them. I have one with Red Dust he did, and I have him on the Lux Radio Theater, and quite a few others.
We're going to turn to one of the great anthology series of radio and a starring role for you, John Gibson, right after this.
Have you ever heard of the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank and wondered where it got its name? If so, you may be interested in this explanation. The Burritt is in recognition of one of this area's most noteworthy citizens of the 1800s, Mr. Elihu Burritt, the learned blacksmith. Elihu Burritt was a self-taught linguist, a patriot, and peace emissary who served his country here and abroad. The mutual came from the fact that the bank is owned by and operated for its depositors. There are no stockholders in the bank. Established in 1889, the bank has served generations of depositors and borrowers in central Connecticut and is today a large, strong, and successful institution. When you save at Burritt, you commemorate the glorious past, you profit from the successful present, and share in the promise of an eventful future. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, a proud mutual savings bank, 2 offices in New Britain, 1 in West Hartford, and another to open this fall for the Wethersfield, Rocky Hill area.
Well, the program I was referring to, Ed, was the Columbia Workshop series.
Yes, that was one of radio's great series, written, I guess, by Norman Corwin, I believe, wrote a lot of them. And we have one tonight called Man Without a Shadow, in which John is one of the featured players. And also Lorene Tuttle, a little unusual, the role she played. John, you tell us a little about that?
Yes, I believe there were something like 14 female roles in this half-hour dramatization, and Lorene played all of them.
Amazing,
which was
it?
Not an economy move on the part of the network. It was simply to illustrate her great versatility. And she played all the women, and it was a story like the Faust story laid in Germany of many years ago.
Well, why don't we listen to it now and hear at least some of the voices and also your own in the Columbia Workshop.
Today's Columbia Workshop presentation captures completely the flavor of old-world theater. Werner Michel has written this play in a style that characterized the original Peter Schlemihl legend. It has a bitter chocolate Central European flavor. It even has an old-fashioned, completely explanatory title, The Man Without a Shadow. Alexander Semler, in composing the music, has done his job in the same conscious manner, using the orchestra with a kind of gaunt good humor. Now let's play it as it might have been played in happier days, at Salzburg, or in the Vienna, broadly with old-fashioned inflection and with...
We're on the air, Mr. Bander.
As if I didn't know. Music, maestro.
Good morning, Mrs. Snyder. Do you have mail for me?
Let me see, mademoiselle. Ah, here's one for your father. And this is for Anna. And, oh, I'm sorry. That is all for today. Oh. Maybe tomorrow. Good morning, mademoiselle.
Maybe tomorrow. Why doesn't he write? He doesn't love me. I would give anything for a loving word from him. I sell my soul to the devil.
So you want to sell me your soul? Very well, mademoiselle. Let's talk the matter over.
Now, take this medicine, Baron. This will help you.
Go away. You will never leave me for my pains, you crack. Before I take any medicine that you have concocted, I would rather sell my to the devil.
Why does everybody in this town want to sell me his soul? I don't doubt, Baron, that you have a very aristocratic one. Perhaps you would go in for another swap? Let's discuss the matter.
I sent you to the market to sell the eggs. Where is the money?
I couldn't sell them, wife.
You couldn't sell them. Why not?
I dropped them.
Oh, why am I punished with a creature like you? If I could get rid of you, I would sell my soul to the devil.
Now, look, madame. I have all the sympathy in the world for you. But I won't buy any more souls. My cold storage is crammed with them, and it's a bad season for souls anyway. I'm sure you have many other things which I might like to acquire. Let's talk it over, if you don't mind.
Such was the situation in the town of A. We cannot divulge its full name, of course, for very obvious reasons, when Peter Schlemiel arrived. He had heard that strange things were going on there, that many people got rich overnight for quite unknown and strange reasons. Peter Schlemiel had set out from home to become rich without too much trouble, and so the town of A seemed to be just the right place for him. It was a fine, sunny morning in the year 1829 when Peter stepped from a proud sailing ship. Now he was standing in the midst of the hurly-burly of the town's busy port.
Excuse me. My name is Peter Schlemiel. Could you...
Don't you see I'm busy?
Pardon my interrupting. My name is...
Party one, stranger.
My name is Peter Schlemiel.
What of it?
Move on, lad. I don't need anyone.
But...
Pardon me, young man. I've been watching you. You seem to seek some information. Can I be of service?
Oh, I'd be very obliged.
Just tell me what you wish. My name is Monsieur X.
Monsieur X? A peculiar name.
I'm sometimes referred to as the unknown quantity.
I am plain Peter Schlemiel. Schlemiel with an S-C-H. And am in search of a modest inn.
Come with me. I'll be happy to show you to one. How do you like our city?
I've made up my mind to like it in spite of these silly tales they tell of it.
I know. Pay no attention to them. It's just foreign propaganda.
I guess you are right. The devil wouldn't like it here. The sun shines too bright.
Very bright, indeed.
The role of Peter Schlemiel is done for us by John Gibson. John, Peter Schlemiel was supposed to be a German, wasn't he?
That's right, which made it rather a problem for me because I didn't have a German dialect in my collection.
You're in one, though.
And the closest I could get was I have a Danish stepfather who still has a Danish accent and what I had was a kind of a polite Danish, I hope, accent.
Well, you did very well. We're going to talk about the anthology series in just a moment.
There is something solid and true about things that have survived the years. Music, drama, art, as personified by tonight's presentation, are manifestations of this. Another is a tried and true institution such as the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, which since 1889 has existed through good times and bad, war and peace, yet continues to grow and prosper with the years. Safety, service, and growth have been the hallmarks of Burritt's progress, all built on the premise of good customer service. You can save at Burritt with confidence, with pride. Why not start your account today? Offices at Corbin's Corner, West Hartford, 267 Main Street, New Britain, Slater Road, New Britain. Deposits insured to $20,000 by Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Well, anthology refers to the type of show that was different every week, like your Lux Radio Theater and your Theater Guild on the Airs, and I think you mentioned that some of the finest roles you played were in series of this nature. Is that right,
Tom? That's right. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall in the U.S. Steel some of the better plays or better moments you had on the air in that particular series?
The play Tommy, for example, and Eugene O'Neill...
Our Wilderness or Strange...
Our Wilderness, of course. Yes. I'm stupid. Yes. Some of those were such wonderful plays, and we had wonderful casts. We worked with wonderful people. We had such a thrill playing these in a big theater with an audience.
Yeah, it was really a lavish production. You have a full orchestra, you have a live audience, and you'd have all top names playing. There was always three or four leading roles, either Broadway or Hollywood actors.
How long would you rehearse for a show like that?
Well, as I recall, we would take several days. I remember the original Lux Radio Theater, before acting became unionized, took a whole week to prepare an hour broadcast. And I think it was somewhat similar with the U.S. Steel Hour.
I would imagine.
Yeah, they were very well done.
Well, we're going to move up to the 1950s for our final excerpt tonight. And this was really the beginning of the end for radio as we knew it, John. Did you recognize that early?
Oh, yes. Yes. For example, I remember going out to Chicago to record a show with Jimmy Durante and Don Ameche when they were happened to be in Chicago and, you know, close enough so that I could go out by train and spend the night and then come back the next night.
Mm-hmm.
And coming through Pennsylvania at this time, I noticed these houses all with the television antennas everywhere you looked. And I suddenly realized I better get out of radio. Because here it is, even out here like Johnstown and places like that, the houses way down the valley had tall antennas and the ones up high had short ones, but they were everywhere. And all of a sudden, radio was slackening up, and whether you like television or not, you had to get into it if you wanted to keep on working.
And, of course, you got into it really in the early stages.
I think it was 1945.
Now, you are a pioneer, because you are celebrating your 25th anniversary with a medium which we all still consider to be young, brand new, almost, in effect.
We put Crime Photographer on at CBS when I don't think more than 20 people saw it. But we worked as hard as if it had been for an audience of 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a half-hour telecast done very legitimately. And it was in 1945, and that was my first. One of the executives at CBS called me back and a few days later, and he said, "We've decided we'd like to do a series of this on television." And I said, "Well, good. Let me know when it's on. I'd like to watch it." And that was my attitude. I hated it.
We're going to play an excerpt from one of the great shows of the 50s in which you appeared, John. Perhaps one of the funniest programs, the Magnificent Montague. Wouldn't you agree, John?
Oh, yes. I think it was quite a classic. Probably not as well known as some, but one of the great radio shows.
Now, who starred in that one, Ed?
Well, it's Monty Woolley.
That's right.
Well, now, in this particular excerpt, what role does John play?
Well, he plays a part of a producer, I believe, or a director. And again, this shows John is really a great comedian as well as a great actor because he gets a lot of belly laughs in this particular excerpt.
And now back to the Magnificent Montague. He is just finishing his Uncle Goodhart broadcast. Listen.
And so, Ronald, here you are again, visiting Uncle Goodhart in his little cottage on the sunny side of the lane, with the police hot on your trail. Now you want Uncle Goodhart to hide a car in his garage. Ronald, where is your memory? You have 7 of them in there already. I understand, Ronald, everybody likes an automobile. But you, Ronald, you like everybody's automobile. Now, Ronald, you ask too much of old Uncle Goodhart. You want me to make a decision for you. Should you join the auto club? This is a question you must ask your own heart, Ronald. But no matter what you decide, Ronald, remember, as you ride out on the highway, with the sound of sirens behind you, always keep your head high into the sun and light. And so ends another episode of Uncle Goodhart. Until he meets you again in his little cottage on the sunny side of the lane, here is Uncle Goodhart with his thought for today. Dear housewives, I was going to read a spring poem to you sent in by Mrs. Ophelia Zett of Mineola, Long Island. It's called Fertilizer, the workhorse of the garden. But housewives, as you know, before we can plant our little gardens, we must get rid of the weeds. There is a weed in our city by the name of Big Ed McClune.
Mr. Montague!
We must weed out Big Ed McClune. He and his gambling empire must be pulled out by the roots.
Mr. Montague, please!
Down with Big Ed McClune!
The opinions expressed by Uncle Goodhart are entirely his own and do not reflect the attitude toward Mr. McClune of anybody around here. Honest!
Let me at that microphone. Down with McClune!
Music! Music!
The air.
Announcer, how dare you cut it half?
Where's Springer, the producer? Oh, there you are, Springer.
Mr. Montague, have you gone?
Now wait, Springer.
Saying things like that about Big Ed McClune on the air. What is that, a new way of committing suicide?
Now, Springer, stop carrying on.
I'll carry on. You'll be carried out. Oh, why did you have to...
Ah, here's our director, Mr. Zinza. Well, Zinza, what did you think of the broadcast?
Oh, it was a rip-snorting Lollapalooza.
Thank you, Zinza. Thank you.
Well, buenas noches, Mr. Montague.
Buenas noches? Well, Zinza, you're not in Mexico.
I will be in a few hours.
Zinza, you've got to stay here and face it.
Shame on you, Zinza. Hadn't you any spunk?
Spunk, schmunk. I'm getting out while the getting's good.
Zinza, come back!
Well, that's the kind of man you are, Mr. Zinza. You turn and run the minute it looks as if there's going to be a fight.
Mr. Montague, I built my whole career around being a coward.
This isn't getting off anywhere. I'd better phone the sponsor.
I guess did.
What'd he say?
Buenas noches.
No, that's the way it is. You're going to leave me holding the bag.
You're not going to be not holding the bag, Mr. Montague.
You're going to be in it.
What's the matter with you two? Haven't you any good red American blood in you?
Sure we have.
We just don't like it to get splashed around.
Mr. Montague, come into my office. You'll have to write a retraction.
A retraction? Never. Springer, if you think I will take back what I said about that monster.
Stop my phone. Hello? What? Right away. Come on, Zinza.
What is it?
They want us in the executive office.
Goodbye, radio. Here's where I go back to selling hot chestnuts.
That was delightful. And our thanks, incidentally, to Jay Hickerson of North Haven, Connecticut, for providing that for us. John, do you remember that role?
Yes, that I do remember.
Very well. This is your line.
It was a classic, I think. Due to Nat Hiken, incidentally, who created it.
Did he actually write some of the scripts, too?
Oh, yes.
He did.
Yes.
Because it is a cut above the humor of that era, no question about it.
He was a genius.
Kathy, where are you going so fast?
To the bank, Richard. I've got to put this money away before I spend it.
Where do you bank, Kathy?
Where everybody banks, silly. At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
At what Mutual Savings Bank?
Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. I use their convenient Corbin's Corner office in West Hartford, but they also have two offices in New Britain.
Well, why the Burritt, Kathy?
It's one bank where I can get 6% for 2-year certificates and 5.75% for 1-year certificates. My money really earns there.
How about their 90-day accounts, Kathy?
Well, they have them, Richard, at 5.25% compounded monthly.
Why do they have Mutual in their name?
Because they're owned by their depositors, Richard, and the profits go to them in the form of dividends. Burritt is the only bank around here with Mutual in their name.
Well, take care, Kathy. I've got to get back to work.
Where do you work, Richard?
At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
What do you do?
I take public opinion polls.
How wonderful, Richard. Would you ask me some questions sometime?
John, looking back over that part of your career, and it's only really a part because you're still active very much so today in television, what are your thoughts about the golden age of radio?
Well, the funny part of radio is you often performed many colorful roles in many colorful scripts, but in a plain, drab studio. So there's nothing visual to remember. It's all mental. It's all in your memory only. And whereas if you had worked in a motion picture, you might have been out on a set out in the, you know, out in the desert or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you would remember it because of that. But year after year, as you worked in radio, it was so wonderful. All you did was wear a decent suit and carry a pencil with you. And you came in and marked your script and went to work, and then you went home. And people didn't know you, which was rather pleasant. You could go anywhere, and you weren't recognized. If you're shy at all, and I think maybe I am a little bit, it's kind of nice.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for being our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. John Gibson, well-known radio actor, today known, I'm sure, by all of you, in television and in motion pictures. And, of course, my thanks to our co-host, Ed Corcoran, for providing us with just a few minutes of his more than 2,000 hours of old-time memories on tape. Ed, we have a great show lined up for next month.
Yes, one of the really big stars besides John Gibson, Rudy Vallee.
And we're going to not only trace the career of Rudy Vallee, but in so doing, we're going to develop the whole story of radio from the very beginnings.
This has been the Golden Age of Radio, brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, New Britain, Connecticut. Safety, service, and growth have been the hallmarks of Burritt's progress, all built on the premise of good customer service.
The Golden Age of Radio is produced by Brian Hartnett. The engineer is Bob Schirego. This is Dick Bertel. Good night.
Camel Cigarettes present Benny Goodman Swing School, the Tuesday evening rally of everybody everywhere who gets a lift from the new pulsating music of youth, swing.
The Lux Radio Theater brings you Rita Hayworth and Charles Corbin in This Love of Ours. Ladies and gentlemen, your producer, Mr.
The makers of Instant Chase and Sanborn Coffee present the Charlie McCarthy Show.